aboard the battleship Pretension. I am Scott Nye.
I am David Bax. Tyler Smith continues to shirk his duties. No, he's
so irresponsible.
Yeah, no, he's still recovering. But if you're following him on Twitter and Facebook, Twitter at More Lessons. I don't know how you find someone on Facebook. You're seeing a lot of updates, a lot of positive updates, both with his respiratory therapy and his physical therapy. Still very slow going, but it's been really heartening to see all of these updates. So check that out. Scott, you had something you wanted to ask me about or talk
smooth about? Transition, David. This is just came up on Twitter over the weekend and has instigated a lifestyle change for myself, and I'm curious to know whether or not this is a lifestyle you follow already. David, do you rinse your mouth after brushing your teeth?
Yeah.
So did I. Apparently you're not supposed to do that. Apparently there's a decent amount of fluoride inside Bowstrength or toothpaste that's really ineffective if you just rinse your mouth immediately after brushing your teeth. So you're supposed to, like, you know, spit out what's in there, of course, but then just kind of let it sit for like 20 minutes and then you're free to rinse and drink water and do whatever else. So I tried this out a couple of times over the last couple of days, and it's very uncomfortable, but it does kind of leave you feeling a little fresher afterwards. I gotta say, I kind of recommend it.
Absolutely gonna try it.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what else to say about that.
Well, for some reason, I remember, because you hadn't been to the dentist for like a long time. There's a long period where you like didn't go to the dentist, but you were insistent that you were very attentive to cleanliness of your teeth. So I didn't know how tuned into teeth culture you were.
No, I don't. Yeah. No, I mean, like a lot of people, I didn't go to the dentist for a long time because of the pandemic. But I, since being vaccinated, I've been to the dentist like at least three times, and I have another appointment next month.
Well, that's too many times. Now you've gone too far.
No, because I ended up having to have a crown, and that, so I had like a checkup and cleaning, and then the crown itself is two separate visits, because they do a mold and they put a temporary crown on, and then you have to like come back to get the permanent crown. Permanent in quotation marks. So far it's been permanent for me. Natalie's crown broke. She has a crown from before, and her crown broke on Christmas Eve 2020.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, like, obviously, no dentists were open, and it was COVID. And so, it, like, yeah, I feel like it was like 9:30 at night on Christmas Eve. I had to put on my mask and go to CVS and buy, like, it's like dental, like, adhesive to just so she could just keep the broken crown on until she could get to a dentist that have it replaced.
I have to assume that just like due to the pandemic or something, you guys were without a nutcracker, and Natalie just had to take the place of the nutcracker and do all the, the nutcracking for you. Why. That's what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. If only I had gone to that CVS to get a nutcracker earlier.
I know, alas.
No, getting a crown sucks ass, by the way. I've never had a root canal. I hear that's bad too. But a crown is bad because they like have to break and pull off part of your tooth, sand it down.
Mm.
And then I think I've said this on the podcast before, but it surprised me what the worst part of getting a crown was.
Okay.
And it is when they pull off the temporary crown to put the new one on. Because there's no like grace or trick to it. They just go into the forceps and rip it off. Like, they've already put some glue on it so it would last the 2 weeks until they could get the real one made, and they just rip it the fuck off. And I was like, I was in shock. It happened so quickly and so painfully.
Well, there's no way they could prepare you for that. That would help them at all. So they're just going to go full on. Yeah, there's it's weird because dentistry has obviously come a long way, and for the most part, they can make it fairly painless, but there are still some parts of it that feel like it's just like they're still doing it the same way the first dentist did.
Are you a good dental patient?
I behave, but I'm very on edge throughout the entire thing.
Yeah. That's like, because I don't even know how to explain it to the dentist or the hygienist. Like, every time I have them doing anything, based on my reaction, they'll be like, oh, do we need to give you more pain?
I get the same thing.
And I'm just like, no, this doesn't hurt. I just hate it. I don't understand how to like make that clear. Cause I'll be like, my fists will ball up and yeah. like my feet point straight forward. And I'm like, just so tense. And it's not because it hurts. It's not that it feels good.
Yeah.
It's not that I'm in pain. It's just that I hate it.
Yeah. It's just grotesquely unpleasant for a long
yeah.
time. Yeah. My dentist offer is like the ability to watch Netflix during the appointment, but like, they're always like waving their limbs in front of it. The whole thing's painful anyway. So I just yeah. don't, I'm just like, it's a half hour. I'll just power through.
With the crown, I did start bringing my, freakedaudio.com earbuds and listening to music loud, which did help a little bit. Total change of pace, but I guess also still mouth related. Gross.
All right.
Speaking of trying new things, I'm very proud of myself because unlike Tyler, I'm going to drag Tyler away. He's not here.
Of course.
I am generally not a picky eater. I eat a lot of different things, but there are a handful of things that I just don't like.
You're out.
But I have a deal with myself that every few years I will try those things again to see if I can make myself like them. Cause I don't like that there's anything I don't like.
Okay.
And I have turned the corner on eggplant.
Okay. Congratulations.
It happened a couple months ago. Natalie and I went to dinner, just a casual dinner at this place called Levant Cafe or Cafe Levant, in Echo Park, which I would recommend. It's very, very chill. And I had like some chicken and rice and she had some eggplant and rice. And I was like, you know what? Let me try that. And I liked it. So this past weekend, we were like going to go to the park with friends. We were going to get takeout and go sit and eat in the park. And so someone was ordering all the Thai food. And Natalie was like, oh, what do you mean to tell them to order? And I was like, you know what? Spicy eggplant basil. And she was like, whoa. And I was like, I'm going all in. And you know what? It was delicious.
All right.
So I'm an eggplant guy now. I really nothing just got to like, yeah, I really just got to get pickles and olives off the list. Because I'm convinced at this point it's something that's psychosomatic because I like other things that are pickled and I like olive oil, you know, in other forms. I just don't know what is my hang up about those two things.
I know we've talked about this before, but have you had a Cubano sandwich with pickles on it?
No, I think, yeah, we did just talk about okay. this.
So, yeah, I think
because that was
my entry point
yeah.
into pickles. And so okay. I think just go for that. It's the classic.
Yeah.
Pretty reliable. Go to El Cochinito. They won best Cuban sandwich in the world at one point. It's a really good Cuban sandwich.
Okay. Okay.
Well,
I like, not to dox you, but I like La Floridita, which is near you.
I know. I need to go there.
As far as Cuban restaurants. Yeah, I think I'm probably due to try some olives again. I'm just trying to figure out what... in what form,
yeah, you
know, maybe on a pizza, because that's like, you know, Natalie's a vegetarian, so obviously if we're gonna get food that we're gonna share, obviously I'm always making the concession of like, okay, I won't get meat, but that's the one concession she has to make is like, if we're getting a pizza or something, she would love to have olives on every pizza, but at best she can do half olive, you know.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's enough bullshit.
All right.
We filled the bullshit quotient of the episode, but I literally just recorded an episode of me and Natalie's podcast where we do a lot more like listener engagement. Like, hey, what do you think of this? Let us know. So I'm like primed to be like, tell us what foods you don't like. Email us at david@battleshipprotection.com. But yeah, feel free to do that. We don't normally do that on this show. So let me tell you about tweakedaudio.com earbuds. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day of my life, whether I'm at the dentist or not. Today I was listening to, I was kind of jumping around today. So I generally try to pick something that I listen to more than one song by the same artist. I guess I was listening to, over and over again, listening to a couple songs by a, punk band that I think are from the UK called Tube Alloys, or I guess they would say Tube. What were they? Tube Alloys. The songs are called Computer Love Again and Jubilee, and I listened to them multiple times because they're so cool. And they sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. So those are available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous. Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Scott, we're back.
We sure are.
And I'm always we're doing a sort of general issue sort of topic today, which is always like, it's fun that we're just going to be like seeing where the conversation goes, but it's also a little bit weird because I'm like, you know, jumping off a cliff or jumping into the pool to see if I can swim because I haven't like, you know, I don't have a list of movies to talk about in front of me necessarily. Right. But I'll tell you how this. So what we're going to, let's get into it, shall we? We're going to talk about what I am calling vulgar auteurism revisited. And I'll give you some background on why this was on my mind. And for those who, you know, who maybe younger listeners who weren't in the trenches back in like 2011, when this was a huge topic, vulgar auteurism was like, arguing in favor of the artistic merit of directors who work in mainstream popular avenues. That's a, you know, we'll get further into it, but that's sort of a general thing about it. And what's interesting about it is that I'm also, you know, a music fan, as much as, not as much as I'm a movie fan, but I'm a big music fan. And around the same time, maybe a few years before, but around the same time, there was a similar movement in the world of music fandom and criticism that is often referred to as poptimism. And I've noticed, so if poptimism was right before vulgar auteurism, I've noticed recently a backlash against poptimism mounting in,
I feel like that was there from the start.
Because I feel like it's mounting, but go ahead.
Well, just because the like rocker crowd was like so anti-poptimist.
But that's what I'm saying is the hipster rockers, I guess, it depends on which rockers you're talking about, because the hipsters pretty much went all in on being like, oh, Kelly Clarkson writes great songs. And now like you've got Stereo Gum covering Taylor Swift and you know, Dua Lipa is like gets just as much ink over there as, I don't know. Maybe not as Wednesday, but as some indie rock band.
Sure.
And so, I feel like within those circles, the circles that did, I think, champion poptimism, I've seen some backlash.
Okay.
And I wonder, is that happening in movies? Is it about to happen? What's different? Because what I think has happened in both cases is that the argument was, hey, this mainstream popular stuff has artistic merit as well. And certain people took that to mean, well, then I don't need to look any further. That like, if, you know, if Michael Bay movies are artistically worthwhile, then why should I also seek out, you know, Radu Jude movies or whatever? Why should I bother? I'm getting my sustenance. You told me that these movies have sustenance. Why do I need to go any further? And so I think that maybe is that's my hypothesis as to where the backlash is coming from, is that there's a resentment of people who think that, and you see this happens on film Twitter every like few months, someone makes a joke about film bros, which doesn't even mean anything anymore.
Right.
And they always imagine it's always a black and white Eastern European movie that they like make up in their heads, you know? And I think that's a part of like, oh, that like, maybe we need to bring back a little bit of elitism to give people something to aspire to look outside what's handed to them.
Yeah. I have many thoughts on everything you just said. I guess I'll start with the last thing, which is an observation I'm stealing from somebody else. But the obvious reason it seems to me that people choose some like either in unspecified or specific Eastern European country is because the people there are still, the films there are so inaccessible. It's not like one of our neighboring countries like France or UK that gets romanticized in mainstream American culture, but is also not so far removed from it that the country would not contain white people. So they can't be accused of being racist. It's like the perfect like geographic center on which to launch their like completely abstract beef. So it's gotten even harder.
By the way, I don't know if it's me or you, but you're lagging a little bit, but I did catch that.
Ah, damn. I will close the tabs. That's about as many as I can get. What was I saying? Right. The other thing is comparing the vulgar autism thing to poptimism is interesting, but I think they were coming from two different camps from the start and had two similar but slightly divergent results. And so like the poptimist thing is, like, I think the name itself alludes to it. It's rooted in a certain like positivity of like almost blind acceptance. And I think that analog in movie culture would be like the Disney fans and Marvel crowd that is just like blind totally into everything that those camps are laying down and insistent that everyone else just like accepts their worth because they're popular. Whereas the vulgar tourism crowd was like, it was looking at mainstream films, but not like, not the feel good kind. Like it was the Michael Bay stuff, which always has like some rough humor in it and sometimes grotesque violence. It was like Tony Scott, which is kind of the similar vein. Paul W. Anderson, who works in like action horror, or like Michael Mann was the closest to like a reputable director that they were getting.
Of the directors you mentioned, or directors, I peek behind the curtain. We just had to stop down and start again because there were lagging issues. So I don't think you mentioned the director that I feel was the biggest sort of beneficiary of vulgar tourism, and that's Jean-Claude Seurat.
Yeah. So this is kind of part two of my thoughts on kind of poptimism versus vulgar tourism. Is like poptimism launched at least a solid decade of like pretty much unquestioned pop dominance, where like, you know, you got all these articles announcing that rock and roll is dead for good and it's just going to be all pop music from here on. Whereas I think vulgar tourism weirdly like coincided with the demise of this kind of film, and it became like a decade of pure Disney reigning, with some small exceptions, Jean-Claude Seurat among them. But like right before like the whole discourse around it kind of exploded, Tony Scott killed himself. And then like Paul W. Anderson is still making films, I think, but let me see what even in the years following, like he made two more Resident Evil movies. He made Pompeii and then took a long break before Monster Hunter came out in 2020. And almost nobody saw that. It just kind of like coincided with a period where the studios weren't making as much middle budget movies, which even though a few of the vulgar auteurist champions were like huge budget things, like, you know, your Michael Bay's, maybe you could say your Roland Emmerich's, for the most part, it was kind of like those middle to even small budget genre movies. I think too of Neville Dean Taylor, who did like the Crank films, like that level of filmmaking, or like Antoine Fuqua, who is now just been stuck in like Equalizer land as far as I know. Look at his filmography now. Oh right, he made Emancipation. That's surprising. But a lot of these kind of films,
he made that,
I know. But like a lot of the kind of films of that tier either went straight to streaming or started getting financed outside of the studio system by like folks like Lionsgate or even smaller distributors who didn't have the same sort of like publicity reach. So these this kind of film just stopped being noticed as much and stopped being even in the routine discourse, which gave it less opportunity to get discussed in a serious way, because the whole adventurous point of vulgar autism was to say, like, yeah, these movies are at least to some degree or another popular and mainstream, but they're worth taking seriously. I would actually say that the best beneficiary of this in a like structural industry-wide sense was the horror genre, which kind of launched on a new wave of this kind of like, what do they call it? Like elevated horror. But that genre is taken much more seriously now. And I think a lot of that kind of started with this, whereas the strong focus on style and not so worried about the fact that the films are often unpleasant to watch.
So I guess not to relitigate vulgar autism from over a decade ago, but maybe a little bit.
Sure.
It did at the time kind of feel to me like the term might be new, and therefore people thought they were discovering something new, but like as if like Walter Hill never existed, you know, or John Carpenter or people like that.
Right.
Like, so I was always a little bit like skeptical of the discussion of vulgar autism, because it just felt like, you know, it always happens when the younger generation thinks they're the first to discover something.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, even like the word auteur, you know, in my understanding, the way that it came to be used by English speakers and Americans is because the like Cahiers du Cinéma fellas were using it when talking about American, yeah, genre pictures, B movies, noir movies, right? Isn't that kind of where auteurism came into the American lexicon? Is that right?
It's slightly more complicated than that. I think that's how people think of the history around auteurism now, and understandably so, because that was its most like, its most obvious beneficiary is like taking those kind of movies seriously and getting, you know, random crime films and disreputable comedies shown as part of like serious, museum installations, rep screenings and all that kind of stuff. Although seeing rep screening at the time is kind of like every theater was engaged in repertory cinema at the time. They were regularly showed old movies because they weren't, there wasn't home video. Like people just went to go see the movies. But yeah. I guess I'm thinking in terms of museums and the rise of cinematheques. But tourism itself started just as much from those same critics trying to champion Ingmar Bergman. And the very first origins that I recall reading up on it is that it was really centered around the idea of a writer director. And so that's at the time, primarily European cinema. And then I think that was kind of the older crowd of the Cahiers du Cinéma writers. So like André Bazin and now I can't remember the name of the guy who founded the French Cinematheque, but Henri something. And then the younger crowds like Godard and stuff really took the reins of that and applied it to American genre pictures that they felt were also auteurist. So in a sense, like this argument's been around forever of like, does this apply to stupid genre movies or not? And of course the answer is yes. And I have always agreed that the vulgar kind of subcategory there is sort of unnecessary because it's just auteurism anyway. And especially at the time they were, you know, this movement was championing a lot of stuff that I was already championing. You know, I think Tony Scott's Domino was on my, I was trying to find physical evidence of this, but I think the blog I used to post it in 2005 is long gone. But I think it was on my top 10 list that year. I've always been like, and I was a big Michael Bay fan, you know, in college as well. So like mid 2000s. So this stuff has always been a big cause celeb for me. So the idea that like, I was kind of thrilled in some sense that it was being taken up as a serious cause, but the idea that it wasn't the same kind of auteurs practicing, you know, you could go both ways about it. One, you could say that it's just like opportunistic and trying to carve out a definition that didn't need to be there, or you could say that's what it took to get these films taken seriously. And for better or worse, I think they are. And I think that the outcome has been fairly positive. Even if I somewhat agree with you that it was potentially inevitable, like you're citing John Carpenter as a perfect example of like somebody who, by the time vulgar auteurism took off, he was already like a lauded auteur, but you still, like, even earlier this year, I saw somebody tweeting out like proudly about like how important it is to like John Carpenter. I'm like everybody's on board at this point. It's completely superfluous to try to say like, oh, we need to rescue the reputation of John Carpenter. No, that's been done. And I think this would have happened inevitably because anything that's a mainstream style ends up falling out of favor and ends up looking better retrospectively. And so like the idea of all this like quick editing, flashy imagery would have by this point in time been really exciting to watch because the current aesthetic of mainstream cinema is largely really dull. And I'm sure there's stuff about the mainstream cinema now that will seem exciting in 10 years too, for reasons we can't predict. I just think it came like so soon that it kind of like threw people off and caught them off guard. But I do think it was inevitable to come at some point.
God, yeah, I shudder to think at which directors I dislike will be lauded auteurs by the next generations of filmmakers. But yeah, again, you kind of cut out a little bit, and I'm glad for the history of the auteurism, but I do kind of feel like you said what I said in a different way, which is that the first time it was law like widely applied to American films. You were saying it was mostly European writer directors at first. The first time it was widely applied to American films was those genre movies.
Oh, for sure. I thought you were saying in terms of like cinema in general, not American movies.
No, I said into the American lexicon.
Gotcha.
Sorry, just like defending myself. I don't know why.
You're good.
So what is the state then? Like, is there, is the pendulum swinging the other way? Is it going to swing the other way? Are we going to get a new generation of super snobby cinephiles who push back against the idea that, these mainstream, genre entertainments are okay? Does this fall into the same bucket when, say, Robert Altman makes Popeye or Greta Gerwig makes Barbie? Like, is that a separate conversation?
How so?
Because Greta Gerwig, and well, let's just talk about Greta Gerwig for now.
Yeah.
She established her reputation as an auteur or whatever, within more quote unquote traditionally respectable genres, with like, you know, starting with independent films and then into like Lady Bird, which is a coming of age story, and Little Women, which is a literary adaptation. Is someone who already has a reputation as an auteur outside of vulgarness coming into vulgar films, is that part of the same conversation or is that a separate conversation?
It seems to me like a separate conversation. And actually there's Sam Adams, the writer at Slate, published a really interesting and pertinent article this past week called title of it. I was looking up. Oh, I'm surrounded with that. It's now Bring Back the Hack. He was specifically citing this in the context of The Meg 2, which is directed by Ben Wheatley, who kind of like rose up from more respectable genre films, but still genre films, but more respectable ones, and then directed this big mainstream bit of nonsense. And the essential point of the article is that we need more like journeyman directors who can just deliver a satisfying time at the movies, and that can be okay. So I think it's separate, but I also think studios are just caught in this cycle of needing to lend their own sense of respectability by constantly hiring notable filmmakers for things. That's why studios pillage Sundance every year for someone to direct, you know, Power Rangers or whatever. And so you're missing out on people who can just deliver quality nonsense, I guess, for lack of a better word. But that's why you end up getting all these very pretentious interviews with the directors saying how like Cassavetes influenced the latest Avengers movie or whatever, because like they feel some need to claw into respectability. Honestly, the press cycle for the new Mission Impossible is really refreshing, because Chris McCrory was like, we just kind of started with like, what do you want to do? So Cruise was like, I want to drive a motorcycle off a cliff. And I was like, I want to crash a train. I think I've earned the right to crash a train. And like, that's how like they got the movie going. But that kind of stuff is so few and far between. I don't know.
It reminds me of back when I was in high school, I was a like huge Smashing Pumpkins fan for a time there. And Billy Corgan in multiple interviews would talk about like his contemporaries and sort of like indie alternative rock. And you'd be like, stop lying and listing Big Black as one of your influences. You know, you were listening to Cheap Trick just like I was.
Right.
He was like, he was always very upfront about how like Cheap Trick was like his favorite band of all time and like a huge influence on his music.
Yeah, I think part of this is like the victory of Ain't It Cool News or something, where like the press cycle for these totally routine movies has become so outsized and important. Whereas like I'm looking at past list of kind of this kind of movie that got championed and trying to find like something from the 90s, maybe that would be a good, let's go with like Paul Verhoeven's movies, which have really been reevaluated over time and have now taken their serious place, but for the longest time were really looked down upon because it's not like Paul Verhoeven had genre friendly websites to go spread the word of how great his movies were. You know, he, you know, maybe got a spot on Entertainment Tonight for a minute and a half or whatever, and the rest of it was just determined by the marketplace. There wasn't like the regular digestion of movie publicity, I guess, that exists today. And so maybe studios feel the need to get out in front of that and have directors who can really speak eloquently about the historical value of what they're doing, rather than just say like, yeah, that was a hell of a thing arranging that car chase.
Well, now you're bringing me back to like my original point, which is about the bad side of that sort of thing and the potential for backlash, which is there are now people who the Ain't It Cool News, there are a billion websites like Ain't It Cool News now. Yeah. And there are people who consider themselves serious cinephiles, and I'm not here to say that they're not, but who like that is the extent of their interest. And I think those are the people who often push back against like, why should I have to watch, you know, a 4-hour Latvian movie or whatever their dumb thing is. And so that's like, that's where I see the potential for, it seems like a sad thing that people are pushing that anyone would push back against the idea that it could be beneficial to their souls to look outside of their narrow interests. But is that also the potential for a new generation of filmmakers or visual artists, whatever you want to call them, to push back against that?
Yeah, I mean, I think like anything, it depends, right? Because a narrow focus isn't bad if you're looking deeply into it. And so there's a really good podcast called Action for Everyone that is exactly what it sounds like. It's really just dedicated to action movies. And is, you know, I don't listen to it every week, or I don't know how often they publish it, but it might just be once a month for all I know. But however often they publish it, I don't listen to it every time, but I listen to it occasionally. And as far as I can tell, they only watch action movies and maybe like other related genre movies, but they don't have like the wide history of film, but they're really smart about action movies. And so it's worth listening to them on that front. And I think like horror fans have always been pretty good about taking their genre seriously to a degree. I mean, horror fans can have such a like all-encompassing taste where like anything with good kills is a good movie, but I think they also have a good sense of humor about when their movies kind of suck and like finding the good things in it, but also acknowledging that the larger enterprise might not work. Every now and again, I'll catch like a really, like someone posted a clip from Saw 4 that had an unbelievable scene transition that I've never seen in any other movie. I'm like, I'm really glad somebody highlighted that. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I haven't seen Saw 4, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. It's cool.
Crazy.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
And so I think horror fans and like more routine genre action fans have always had this kind of good sense of things. I really think it's the kind of people you're talking about are very much limited to like just nerd movies and like really emphasizing how valuable Pixar and Marvel and Disney and whatever else is kind of in that circle are. Or, I mean, frankly, if you want to flip it, like the Snyder Bros, which Zack Snyder, I think, has a good foothold to call himself a vulgar tourist, or an auteurist by any stripe. But, their like rabid insistence that everything in those movies is great devalues the potential for really discussing those movies seriously. So I don't think it's necessarily a problem for there to be websites or podcasts or whatever else, or YouTube channels, I understand are very popular. My biggest like old man thing is I don't watch any YouTube videos that are like discussing anything.
Yeah.
But I understand that there's a
popular way to... I use YouTube for, I use YouTube to watch heavy metal music videos and performances and ASMR if I need to like relax and focus while I'm working or writing or something. Those are the only two things I use YouTube for.
Yeah, I don't even use it for that much, but I understand it's a popular medium for discussing and unveiling film criticism. But anyway, I know there are a lot of channels like that, or they're very myopic and not terribly curious about their design subject other than discussing the potential box office for them. But aside from those, I just don't think that it's necessarily a problem as long as people are doing the work and there's room in these movies to do the work.
Okay. So, let's bring it back to your optimism. Is there still a place in the conversation for the vulgar artist argument? Are there enough films like this to be championed? And is championing them still worthwhile when so much of the film loving, the cinephile sphere seems to be on board?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think certainly championing the original movies is like an active endeavor. As a avid rep goer, I've noticed a huge uptick in like 90s and mid 2000s movies being screened. So like the fact that I was able to see Crank at the American Cinematheque is like pretty wild, but very cool. On 35mm Nash. And so I think that will only continue because they really draw crowds of people who are a little nostalgic for that period. And that will trickle down into DVD and Blu-ray distributors and all the rest. Where I am a little more curious about is whether these kinds of films will continue to be made at all. Whether horror can break out of its like trauma cycle of everything comes back to being about some group of people's trauma. The success of movies like Malignant and Megan is pretty encouraging, where it's just pure insanity. Mm-hmm. And there's enough kind of happening on the fringes of the industry that kind of suggests people are hungry for these kind of movies. You know, we talked about a couple of years ago, The Scary of 61st, which I think is kind of in the vein of these types of movies. And there's something else that I saw from this year that kind of stood out. Well, really like a movie like Skinamarink, Knock at the Cabin from this year was pretty successful. And that was a very exciting, straightforward genre movie, or even like the John Wick movies. Those kind of continued in their little vein. So I hope so. And it seems like people are kind of turning out more. And honestly, I mean, we kind of like had Barbie as a kind of sub instance of this because it has some genuine auteurist cred, but it's also a big piece of weird cinema, which is exciting to see succeed. And hopefully others, you know, there's obviously a push now to make a bunch of toy movies, but hopefully someone will see that a lot of what people responded to was just being big and weird and funny. So I think there's room for it. I tend to be optimistic about things, even when presented with all the evidence otherwise. You never really know.
Good. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned John Wick, because I feel like my next question is sort of like how Patty Jenkins had that that interview years ago, wondering like, are any new reputations being made in streaming? Like, are people forging careers? Is greatness being established? And I'm glad you mentioned John Wick, because like Chad Stahelski is someone who is like a new name since this has happened, a new auteur. The other one I would point to, even though I think his filmmaking career goes back to the original, I think, vulgar auteurism discussion, but and now I'm drawing a blank, John Hyams, I think is his name, who made like started making Universal Soldier sequels, and then has kind of like branched out slightly into thriller and horror. The last two movies, Alone and Sick, are both great. Sick is on Peacock. If you're one of those people who, if you have Peacock and you already watched, I don't know. I don't even know why people get Peacock. I have Peacock, but
you'd have to tell me. Yeah, I can tell you.
Yeah. nothing against Peacock. It's, I mean, I like Brooklyn Nine-Nine. That's what I use it for. Anyway, that's another person who's like a newish name. So I guess, we should wrap this episode up because of the internet problems we're having, but I'm having, let's not like spread the blame where it doesn't, deserve to be, but you're giving me some optimism there. But my fear, of course, is that, some of these directors make one film and then get scooped up by a Marvel or something, or another Disney franchise or something like that. There's also the problem with people make a great first film, or at least a first film that is celebrated. And then you look at their IMDb and they've just done a bunch of episodes of TV since then. And it's like, I get it, because often they're like prestige shows or whatever, but it's like, it feels like we're, you know, those of us who still, the few of us who still like movies better than TV are keep losing potential new auteurs to season 3 of Queen Sugar or whatever.
Well, now that streaming's dying, hopefully we'll be rid of that too.
All right. Well, yeah, this is going to be the shortest episode we've done in a while, but I don't know what to do about these internet issues. But I think we got some good conversation out of it. I also think that I like learned a lot. You've clearly like thought about this more than I have, which is funny that I brought up the topic. But I feel like this was a good episode.
Yeah.
Scott, thanks for bearing with me.
No worries.
Yeah, you can find us in the usual places. You find Battleship Pretension in the usual places. Check out The One Where I Met Your Mother. Check me out on Letterboxd at David Bax. Scott, where do you want people to find you?
On Twitter at Rail of Tomorrow. And you mentioned earlier that people can email us with their thoughts on eating and stuff. I always forget to mention my email, but feel free to email me at railoftomorrow@gmail.com. I haven't been using the old Blueski as much lately, but Rail of Tomorrow there as well.
I noticed that, actually.
Letterboxd. I know.
Because I'm
failing.
I'm mostly on Blue Sky. But then when I run out of Blue Sky, which happens because there's only, like 1,000 people on the entire app, then I go back to Twitter. But I've been spending as much time on Blue Sky as I can. All right. Well, thanks again for putting up with this. Thank you for listening. And you probably had a lot to put up with too. And
we'll get you next time.
All right. Bye.
Bye.